Welcome to At the Table, Christian Community for the Common Good, a podcast for folks curious about the church's call to be faithful neighbors in the places where they live and worship. I'm your host, Nicholas Tangen. Thanks for being here. Now, pull up a chair and let's talk about what's possible when neighbors come together at the table.
It's about asking questions of people and really moving them out of that headspace and into the heart space, which is scary.
Totally.
For a lot of people.
Yeah.
And less predictable. So less predictable, because if we can just be logical and follow a chain of events, then we will be fine and we'll get to a logical conclusion. Yep. Except there's nothing logical about racism.
Yeah.
I mean, it was created.
Right.
It's a created thing.
Yep.
And we're not going to logic our way
right
out of it.
Yeah.
We're not going to logic our way out of it.
Yep.
Until you can, in your heart, see me, feel me as a human being.
Yeah.
And not other.
Yep.
If you can't see my humanity, if you can't.
I
mean, it is about being vulnerable to learning something different.
My guest today is my good friend Felicia Boone. Felicia is a senior diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant with Hennepin County and vice president of the Minneapolis Area Synod of the ELCA. She's my first returning guest and one of my favorite conversation partners. I asked Felicia to join me for a conversation about growing up in the church and how she sees her day job as a DEI consultant intersecting with her role as a leader in the Lutheran Church. We talk about her home congregation, Calvary Lutheran Church, and why the call to be faithful neighbors with an eye towards equity is the work of every church. Felicia and I always have a blast when we get to spend time together, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. Felicia, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
You're our first returning guest.
Woo woo. Look at me.
I know.
I am.
So honored. Well, the last time you were here with Emily and Eric, and we were talking about Christian community. And you were talking about church as a place that has been support and has been there for you. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. Just tell us a bit about what did church look like for you growing up? How did faith show up in your home and your family? And
sure. It showed up in three, as I think back, three distinct ways. So first, school.
Yeah.
So I've gone to Lutheran schools all my life.
Okay.
Kindergarten through college.
Nice.
Like, I think of, other than college, I think of Lutheran school as Missouri Synod.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So that's the one of the ways it showed up. So interestingly, being in a, well, before it became the ELCA, the congregation I belonged to was LCA. And I was quite participative in church as a youth. And I didn't understand the different denominations. And so we would have chapel on Wednesday. So we'd walk across the street to go to chapel. And the boys, whoever, you know, it rotated, would always go back in the sacristy and get on the albs and the things and to be... to light the candles.
Yep.
And I remember asking once, like, how come the girls never get asked to, like, and I don't remember the response, but I was like, I get to do it at my church. Like, I get to carry the chalice or light the candles. I don't think I really got a response, which is why I don't really remember it, but it was kind of like, we don't do that here. Yeah. So that was a disconnect for me. At home, I remember sometimes not wanting to get up and go to Sunday school.
Classic.
And my dad always making us. And I'm like, well, you don't go to church. Why do I got to go if you don't got to go?
Do as I say, not as I do.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And then my grandparents. So I would go south, like many African-American children in the north would go south to spend their summers with their grandparents. And they went to Baptist church.
Sure.
Which I didn't love the length, mm-hmm. but I loved the music. I also recognized at a young age that like everybody around me knew their Bible. So mm-hmm. even at Sunday school, mm-hmm. and they'd call out Bible verses, kids could get, and I was like, by the time I found it, they were on to the next, to yeah, the next right. Bible verse. And I'm not going to say that I'm much better today. So that's something I need to work on.
It's a bit of a different culture mm-hmm. around scripture there in your Lutheran church and your Baptist church experience.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, yeah, so always I don't, bit of family lore. I don't remember this. Mm-hmm. We started out going to Baptist church.
Okay.
Here when I was young, mm-hmm. like toddlerish age. And then there was a period where we weren't going to church until we found the Lutheran church a couple blocks away from our house. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking about it later in life. And my mom was like, because you complained. And they I'm guessing they didn't want to go either at that point, or they didn't, whatever was happening, and they let the toddler decide. Say, church is too long, so. Yeah.
Let's go Lutheran.
There you go.
Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. that's great. So yeah. toddler Felicia, the Lutheran church was just.
That was my jam.
That right. was your jam. Mm-hmm. All right, that's good to know. I like yeah. that. I remember in the last conversation you mentioned that you had kind of strayed from the church like a lot of folks, but then I think you said in your 20s or maybe in college, you had this experience that kind of told you you were being called back to the church. Would you be willing to say anything about that?
Sure. So while I continued being involved in Lutheran institutions, mm-hmm. There was a big kerfuffle. So not long after the ELCA was formed, so mm-hmm. 87. So mm-hmm. I graduated in 87.
Okay.
Freshman year, fall of 87. Big kerfuffle in my congregation related to the pastor. I'm not going to get into that here. Maybe that's a different podcast. but when I would talk with my parents on Sunday, that was our designated call time. Mm-hmm. And my mom would share with me what was going on. Like, she was getting calls. And I was like, oh my goodness, people.
Yeah.
Like, this is not what church, this is not what mm-hmm. we do. So I just kind of was like done. So yeah. even though I had religion classes and all that, like very rarely did I ever go to chapel unless I had to.
Right.
When I came back home, wasn't going mm-hmm. to church. It was probably in my mid-20s. I had a second job, mm-hmm. excuse me, out at the Mall of America working at retail. And it was quiet. And I was up at the front of the store, so by the door, straightening the racks. And I hear clearly, clear as day, man's voice saying, mm. go home. And I turn around to the door, and there's nobody there.
Mm.
Like, must have wafted in from somebody yeah, walking right. by, right? go back to straightening clothes, mm. and I heard it again. Go home. Like,
Okay.
All right. Okay. Not long after that, a friend of mine, we grew up together, mm-hmm. And he was like, hey, have you been back to Calvary? And I'm like, nah, I'm kind of done with it. He's like, no, really, you should go back. And I'm like, all right. So I'm back a few times, you know. Okay. Pastor Becky and one of the adults in the church scheme together cornered me after church one Sunday and said, hey, how would you like to go to New Orleans?
Love New Orleans.
Never been. Sounds great to me. I've always wanted to go. They're like, yeah, well, the National Youth Gathering is going to be in New Orleans, and we need an adult chaperone
yep.
to go. You'd be perfect.
Yep.
And I had visions of, I'm gonna tuck those kitties into bed at the hotel, and I'm going to hit the French Quarter. That was one of the first experiences that taught me to read the fine print.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the curfew applies to
adults too.
The adult chaperones yeah. too.
I feel like that's classic youth worker scheme. Like, there's a young adult in the congregation. Mm-hmm. We think they're great. You know what? We're going to get them to be a chaperone.
Mm-hmm.
Hooked. Yeah.
So I went on a few National Youth Gathering trips as a chaperone mm-hmm. and some service trips around the U.S. as a chaperone, and I loved it. Yeah. It was great. It was great to be with youth. Those youth are now adults. Mm-hmm. I'm old.
So you work as a senior DEI or diversity, equity, inclusion consultant for Hennepin County. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how did you come to this work? What was it that drew you to this work? And maybe, you know, how did you see God at work in that discernment around this vocation?
That's such a great question. And I don't think I fell into it, mm-hmm. which so many people of my era did, because there wasn't a certificate for it, right? And often it was just the, I kind of started when it was just the diversity.
Right.
Before the I was even added.
Before the E, before the I.
Yeah. Right. And honestly, it happened because someone that I still mm-hmm. work with this individual, have a deep respect for was the employee development manager. So when I'd left the county, worked at the attorney general's office, came back to the county, and this person had promoted into a role of employee development manager, mm-hmm. and she kind of pulled me and said, she's like, hey, I'm would you like to learn this? Mm-hmm. And she is also a Christian, mm-hmm. not a Lutheran, but she is also a Christian. And so we've had conversations and we've propped each other up when things have gotten, we've had mm-hmm. moments where we've had like, okay, we're going to meet on Wednesdays at 7 a.m. and we're going to pray for each other and whatever, because things were hard and to get through, but she taught me and she brought me in. And then when she promoted into another role, I actually applied then for that role that she was mm-hmm. leaving and got it. And it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun. It wasn't the type of diversity at that time, which was often about beating people up mm-hmm. And telling them how horrible they were. How people ever thought that was effective, I don't know.
Yeah. Effective for who? That's maybe the...
yes, and even then it's not effective for them.
Right.
And so seeing the progression, so government moves fast when it wants to. Yeah. Otherwise, there's a real steady pace
that sounds
things.
Familiar.
Not like church at all.
Not like church at all.
I think it was that patience of prayer. Now that I'm thinking back on it based on this question, and knowing that the work was for good, mm-hmm. Not just for us and other people that look like us, but mm-hmm. for the organization as a whole and for the residents, right? So there were a series of things of growth that needed to happen in the organization to be mm-hmm. ready to add the E.
Yep.
And it took years.
Yeah.
It took years to get there, but we are now in a place, and I'm not saying we're perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but we're now in a place where it is the language, mm-hmm. right? You had to build the foundation. And I think that's the same thing that's true for the church. And so there is that foundation, but race hasn't been a part of that mm-hmm. foundation. So we have to build the foundation so that people have the capacity mm-hmm. to understand why it's important mm-hmm. and that this isn't about locking anybody out either. Right. 'Cause I think there's some of that too. Yeah. Well, and I often say to people don't fear change. Mm-hmm. They fear what they're going to lose or what they think they're going to lose.
Yes.
And so people haven't done, in my opinion, mm-hmm. the work to figure out what the benefit is to doing this. And if we really believe that all of God's children mm-hmm. deserve a seat around the table, then that's the benefit.
Yep.
Then you're really not losing anything.
Yep. Amen.
Every majority culture congregation I talk to in the city or the first ring suburbs of Minneapolis talks about how conscious they are of the changing demographics of their neighborhood. It's becoming clear to people that the folks in the pews look less and less like the people in the community. There's some anxiety about this, and I don't sense that churches know quite what to do with the realization. They're often unfamiliar with their own congregation's ties to white flight, gentrification, and shifting demographics over the years. And they're often genuinely curious and interested in building meaningful relationships with the folks who live in and near their neighborhoods. I can feel this sense of urgency to step beyond the walls and learn again to be the neighbor. And sometimes, this urgency picks up speed for very tragic reasons. In May of 2020, on the corner of Chicago and 38th in Minneapolis, George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a police officer with the Minneapolis Police Department. This event triggered a mass movement for racial justice in the United States and uprisings across the country. Calvary Lutheran Church, Felicia's home congregation, located a block and a half south of George Floyd Square, was suddenly thrust into the middle of a mass movement for social change, and had to wonder what the call to be neighbor in this moment would look like. I asked Felicia to reflect on why it matters that we connect with our neighbors across culture, race, and ethnicity, and to reflect on the impact George Floyd's murder had on her own faith community.
How I talk about it at work is different than how I would talk about it at church, but that scarcity mindset versus a mindset of abundance. And I think if, as Christians, especially in the ELCA, we need to operate out of abundance. Mm-hmm. And if we see that our siblings don't have that, what are we doing then, folks?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Jesus wasn't just about his household.
Yeah, for real. I think that's kind of what got him in some trouble.
I think so.
A little bit of trouble.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Good trouble, though.
Yeah. Real good trouble. You bring up kind of the way you talk about it in church. And one thing I wanted to mention, you and I both work or are kind of working within kind of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. This is a dominant culture church, predominantly European descendant. And so to your point, right, DEI, the way diversity, equity, inclusion shows up in churches is always context dependent, right? It's always... Yes. There is no 10-point plan that every community, every church, every neighborhood can just take and
right.
And
it's not boilerplate.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think as I think about like the audience for this podcast, I think it's largely those mainline kind of congregants and folks thinking about connecting to the neighborhood. And I think in that context, one of the common refrains we hear around the mainline churches, you know, is that our churches don't reflect the demographics of our neighborhood anymore, right? We've got these shifting neighborhoods, but our churches are still looking the same. They're not reflecting so much. I think that's often tied to that kind of like anxiety about church decline. But I'm wondering if you could say something about why does that question matter? Why does it matter that our churches reflect the communities where we gather?
You just said it. It's where we gather. Hmm. And two people get scared about reflecting the demographic. Again, it's about what am I going to lose if, well, then I don't get to sing my favorite hymns and we're not going to start on time and they're going to bring weird food to the potluck and
they're going to bring weird food. Yeah. And the churches in my neighborhood are famed for their lutefisk cook-off. So let's,
right, I've seen it on the news. I almost tasted it once at a thing, and I couldn't.
You're not missing much.
I couldn't do it, and I'm not going to understand them. They're going to want to change everything, and yet making people conform only to your way isn't helpful either. That's missing. Thinking back to the Bible, I think Jesus ate and broke bread with a whole bunch of different people.
Most certainly.
At a time. It wasn't only going here.
Yep.
Or only going here. It was bringing all of these people together.
Yeah.
And I think that can be the beauty in the, if we take the time to slow down and hear the commonalities.
Yeah.
Then we can move forward. We're not always going to agree, and we don't have to. But if we can't even see, if we can't even start at the places where we have things in common,
right?
Values, now how they show up, mm-hmm. how they're demonstrated may be different, but they're there.
Yeah. One of the other things I was thinking about recently too is that it's not often spoken this way, or it's not the story isn't often told this way, but I feel like sometimes there's this idea that our churches are where they are like on accident.
Mm.
You know?
No.
That like but I think more and more I feel so certain that God has called churches to be church in place on purpose, right? Like that God doesn't mm-hmm. do things accidentally.
Yeah.
And churches get formed for all kinds of reasons. You know, old churches, old Lutheran churches, you know, in Northeast were German and Scandinavian immigrants, right?
Right.
And gathering in particular Scandinavian or German neighborhoods. That was on purpose. And now I think the question is, what's the on purpose that God has for us in the neighborhood now?
Ooh, I like that. The mm-hmm. on purpose that God has for us in the neighborhood now. Well, I can speak to Calvary
yeah.
a little bit
yeah.
there. COVID hits. We have to move our food shelf
mm-hmm.
outside.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, you talk about being a visible presence in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Made all the difference.
Seriously.
In the world.
Yep.
Not only for the people who needed to utilize the food shelf, mm-hmm. but for the neighbors.
Yeah.
In that moment, it became even more so a mm-hmm. neighborhood food shelf than Calvary's food shelf, because the neighbors were the ones who could get there.
Right. Yep.
And then when George Floyd was murdered, we knew people and people knew us. Like yeah. they always knew Calvary, and people had mm-hmm. referred to Calvary as its church,
yeah.
though they never, you know, came on a Sunday or yep. participated in
yep.
any of the things.
The kind of parish model of church.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But even more so, mm-hmm. it became people's church.
Yeah.
Set up the courtyard for 612 MASH.
Mm-hmm.
Should people need to do that? Used some empty classrooms for stations for if people got tear gas. They knew they could go there, and we had mm-hmm. milk and, you know, the little waiting pools that people yeah. could stand in so they could be doused and all of that stuff. So even more so, I think, because of the pandemic forcing us outside, because we always said our doors are open.
Yeah.
Well, okay, great. Again,
yeah.
Who's going to come up the big stairs to mm-hmm. the big door and walk in, and you don't know what you're going to get when you get yeah. to the other side of that door?
It puts all the onus on the neighbor.
Absolutely.
Right? Hey, our doors are open. You can walk in whenever
Anytime.
You want. Yeah.
Being outside forced us to engage
yeah.
in a new way and see people and mm-hmm. have people see us.
Yes.
And that's been so hugely, mm-hmm. hugely important
yeah.
in creating the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't done with the expectation that people are going to become members of Calvary
yep.
and people are going to give offering to Calvary. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, none of that was done with that yeah. in mind, but it was truly about being neighbor.
Right. Remind me, how close is Calvary to George Floyd Square?
One block south.
One block south, yeah. What was that? What was that like for Calvary when that, when George Floyd was murdered? I mean, that becomes this staging ground for what
yeah.
would be then the uprisings and
mm-hmm.
protests, months and months of protests.
Yeah,
and
it became. We stood up a welcome table.
Mm-hmm.
We had snacks and water and hand sanitizer and masks and mm-hmm. a place of respite. And I don't know who it was that reached out and said, hey, we need a chaplain ministry mm-hmm. here to just have people be able to talk
right.
to people. I mean, our congregation and people in the neighborhood also volunteered
mm-hmm.
To do that. It opened us up in a way
mm-hmm.
that I don't know that it's ever mm-hmm. really been like that. Like we've had
yeah.
neighborhood partnerships before.
Totally.
But in some ways there was still kind of that paternalistic thing because we owned the building.
For sure.
They were, so even though there were partnerships, it was different. This was a true collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are people in the neighborhood. I mean, not anymore because we've sold the building, but people in the neighborhood who were working with the food shelf or the welcome table had keys to the building.
Right. Right.
Like, we can't be here, or nobody from Calgary's going to be able to be here till then, but if you can get this stuff set up and get it out and blah, blah, blah.
There you go.
Because we know keys are powerful things.
Oh, keys are powerful
things. They're a powerful symbol.
Peter's got some.
keys to the kingdom?
Peter Block, actually, it just made me think of this. Peter Block, one of the questions for his six conversations for building community, one of the questions is, what commitment are you willing to make without any expectation of return?
Ooh.
And I love that because I think that's exactly what you're saying. The Calvary was opened up in a new way because you were making a commitment to the neighborhood without that expectation of membership or money coming in or, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there were times though, and again, no expectation, but there were times in a month where the food shelf took in more money than the general than the general fund.
The members are just looking at each other like, don't say nothing, but you know,
like, look at that.
How did that experience impact, or how was it impacted by Calvary's own kind of internal work around racial equity and justice and diversity, equity, inclusion?
Yes. So speaking of groundwork and preparations, I don't remember what year this was, but our pastor in that moment, I mean, it was planned, went on sabbatical. And it was, we were intentional. So he even named it, right? Roots and Wings. So part of the roots was spent half of the sabbatical in Norway with family and genealogy stuff, and the Wings part was going to South Africa for the other half. We were also doing our intentional work around racial equity. We intentionally hired a biracial husband and wife pastor team to come in and focus on race. Was it easy? Nope. We had people who said, I'll be back when pastor comes back.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know this is what we were going to, we were like, we were very clear with you on more than one occasion that this is what we were going to be talking about and focusing in on during the sabbatical time.
This is the classic, like, church bulletin frustration, right? Like, it's in the bulletin, it's in the email.
Oh, no, it was in the bulletin, it was in the email, it was shared from the pulpit multiple times.
Yeah.
We didn't know this was going to happen, you did too. There were people who were upset. But we got through it.
One of the things I hear kind of under the fear of folks around engaging the DEI conversation in their congregations is exactly what you're saying. Are we going to get through this? You know, like, is this going to split us up? Are we not going to make it because it's going to be so divisive? It's just going to tear the church apart. What was it about Calvary that you think kind of helped hold you all together through what was obvious, you know, like you said, a difficult conversation?
Yeah, and we're still having that in 2023. We're still having that difficult conversation with people who are like, why are we still talking about this? And I'm like, you parent, well, oh, okay. enough people wanted to learn, I think.
Yeah.
And I think people genuinely want to, they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Yeah.
And they care about you. And I'm like, okay, well, if you care about me, this is a part of my life. This is a part of my life, too. This is the part you don't see. This is the part you don't live when you leave here or you're not talking to me. This is the stuff.
Right. A couple things you said that a couple things I heard in what you said. One was Calvary had, at least among some of the members, like a sense of humility, like a genuine curiosity, like a wanting to learn and realizing, hey, we don't have all the answers. We want to learn. This commitment to the community, like, hey, this is going to be hard, but I love you And so let's do this together. That kind of commitment. That was I hearing you right in that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because at a certain point, somewhere in that timeline, mm-hmm. was a point where I grew up in that church.
Yeah.
And I was not feeling welcome.
Right.
In that church.
Yeah.
And I did have a conversation with the pastor at that time. And I said, look, I'm not telling you this to hold you hostage. Yep. I'm telling you that I'm not feeling welcome. Mm-hmm. I am currently assessing whether or not I'm going to be able to stay here.
Yeah.
And I recognize that I'm not the only member of this congregation. Mm-hmm. But I just need to let you know what I'm experiencing Absolutely. Right now. For as much as people want to say, Felicia's a child of the church. Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. And I'm not feeling it, people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, which really pained me. Mm-hmm. Because I was trying to figure out where I would go.
Yeah.
So from completely stepping away to like,
right.
I don't know where I would go.
Yeah. If I don't belong here.
If I don't belong here.
That was the third thing I was hearing in what you said was that relationship. That this work fundamentally is relational too, right? I think.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you, I mean, one of the places where we, as the church, we often kind of... misstep around the diversity equity work that we try to do in our congregations. One of them that I see often is that we keep it theoretical, right? We think it's this kind of like brain game. And if we just get all the right information, we'll be able to kind of jettison all the kind of racist stuff. Or, you know, all the places where we hold bias or mm-hmm. any of that. How do you find yourself kind of confronting that maybe in your work or in church, or is it just a big glass of wine at the end of the day?
There have been those days. It's about asking questions of people and really moving them out of that headspace and into the heart space, which is scary.
Totally.
For a lot of people.
Yeah.
And less predictable. So less predictable, because if we can just be logical and follow a chain of events, then we will be fine and we'll get to a logical conclusion. Yep. Except there's nothing logical about racism.
Yeah.
I mean, it was created.
Right.
It's a created thing.
Yep.
Race is a created thing. And we're not going to logic our way out of it.
Yeah.
We're not going to logic our way out of it
yep.
until you can, in your heart, see me, feel me as a human being and not other.
Yep.
Because that's head stuff. It's so easy to, that's foreign. I don't have to deal with that. If you can't see my humanity, if you can't, I mean, it is about being, vulnerable to learning something different. And I say it that way is because most people of color have to code switch all the time. We're used to navigating in dominant space because we have to be because it's about safety. Am I going to get home alive today?
In 2020, my own church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, released a worship supplement titled All Creation Sings, which includes a prayer for lamenting racism. The supplement says, quote, "We are all part of one body in Christ, called to act with equity, fairness, and justice. God's saving love creates grace-filled spaces within us and within our relationships. God's saving love calls and leads us towards rooting out the racism that continues to infect the body." End quote. This is followed by a series of petitions asking God to open our hearts. When one part of the body of Christ hurts, the whole body hurts. As we listen to people who are harmed by racism, we call to you, open our hearts, O God. As we reflect on our daily interactions with people and communities of color, we call to you, open our hearts, O God. As we labor to create a loving and safe community for our siblings of color, we call to you, open our hearts, O God. This call to openness and to humility as we engage the work of relationship building in our neighborhoods was reiterated in my conversation with Felicia. Her experience as a DEI consultant and as a leader in the church has shown her that churches can often show up with a sense of entitlement, as if they're owed a relationship with neighbors. Instead, she invites us to embrace humility, to stop overcomplicating the most basic human interactions, and to do our own personal work to disentangle racism and cultural hubris from our daily lives. I asked Felicia what advice she has for congregations committed to being the neighbor in the place where God has called them to gather.
Undoing so much of that socialization, I mean, that's part of this work, right? And some of that is, like you were saying, it's that exposure to relationship, willingness to be vulnerable. Growing up in Rosemount, Minnesota, you know, Dakota County, you know, the very, very white community. And it felt like the only time we ever really talked about people of color was in that kind of frame of needs, right? It was, you know, around questions around poverty or questions around housing or pieces like that. And it often felt very like it was coming from this place of concern, right?
Yes.
But to your point, it was a completely dehumanizing narrative that allowed us to maintain a posture of provider and privilege and, you know.
Yeah, that whole paternalistic thing.
Right.
It's like our friend Jim Bear Jacobs, like, please do not go on another service trip to a reservation.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Right. Right.
It's not helping.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing what you think it is,
yep.
Especially if you're going to come there in judgment and, like, you go there every 3 years and you're like, we did the three, it looks just the same as it did 3 years ago. Yeah, because you didn't actually talk to anybody and say, what do you actually need?
Yeah.
What can we actually do that's going to be effective?
Yeah. Or what can we create together?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
And so there's often not this posture of humility.
Mm-hmm.
We know best.
Yep.
We know what you need. No, you don't.
Nope.
No, you don't.
Yeah. And when we talk about, like, building towards the common good in a neighborhood, you can't build towards the common good if you're constantly building towards your own good, right?
Exactly. Like, yes.
That's an impossibility. And so in some ways too, I mean, there is no world in which congregations engage authentically in their neighborhood where they're not doing this diversity, equity, inclusion, anti-racism work, right? It's
absolutely
a prerequisite.
It's a prerequisite. And often when they're doing that work too, it's about preserving their own thing and thinking that the community wants something.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's something that they think they want. It's an exchange, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's goods and services.
Yep.
And it's not that. It is the relationship.
Yes.
Now, the goods and services may come
absolutely
later.
Yep.
Once we know each other.
Yep.
And you actually understand.
Yep.
And I understand you and you understand me. And now we've worked towards this collaborative whatever. And it's not, you know, you're not handing me a check and patting me on the head and sending me away and like, oh, I've done such a good deed.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at the budget and grumbling.
Yeah, right, exactly.
that's not helpful.
No. It does. You're right. I mean, it takes that vulnerability, that willingness to open ourselves in such a way that we're willing to be transformed by the relationship we enter into. Right?
Absolutely.
And I get that. That is scary, right? Like, you know, some days I feel pretty good about where my life is. Do I really want to open myself up and be transformed that way? But I think the invitation of, and often not even just the invitation, often it's just the, like, straight up dragging of Jesus is into that kind of that openness, right?
Yeah. Because it's often what I've seen, heard, experienced from people is they want, I call it fluff and buff church.
Yeah.
Oh, wrap me in cotton wool and
mm-hmm.
all is right with the world. No.
Uh-uh.
because I know these folks are also going through hard things. I mean, that's to me, that's what no one's living a perfect existence. Mm-hmm. And that, and church, again, yes, it can be that soft place mm-hmm. to land while dealing with difficult things.
Yes. Yes.
But we need to acknowledge that there are difficult things. Church is not a church does not protect us from the difficult things, mm-mm. right? It doesn't.
We each of our churches has a cross at the front of it. Like, in no way, shape, or form should we be afraid of difficult things.
If we're following who we say we follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe on that note, you know, you've worked with folks in the government, folks in the church. You're the vice president of the Minneapolis Area Synod. God bless you. What are some of the gifts and strengths you feel like churches can bring to this work of diversity and equity and anti-racism? What are the things we already have that we can put to use towards this work?
Genuine compassion and care for the person next to you.
Mm-hmm.
We know churches do that well. Your kid is sick. Your spouse is in the hospital, and nobody can get a food train going faster, I swear to goodness, right? We'll take care of this. Okay, put your laundry in a basket on the porch. You don't have to even see me. I'll mm-hmm. come and do it. I'll pick it up, and I'll bring it back. We care for each other really well.
Yeah.
When we know each other.
Yeah.
And we can do that with the stranger. I'm mm-hmm. using air quotes. The stranger, too.
Mm-hmm. The neighbor.
The neighbor. The foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
The refugee.
Yeah.
The widow. Right? We know how to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Are we willing to step out of our bubble?
Yeah. Right. Right.
For the good of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just what you're saying, too. I mean, I think one of the gifts we have is our belief in this God who walks along with us towards the cross, walks with us into the hard stuff, and is always promising that something new is going to come out of that, and something better, something less burdensome.
And so what causes us, now I'm asking you, what causes us to say the words
mm-hmm.
and not lean into it?
Yeah. I often, I feel this way about, community engagement and neighborhood work, too, that it's not boilerplate. There is no 10-point plan. I feel like often, especially for dominant culture churches who, want to do it right, they want, give us the next step. So I say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, as someone who has been walking alongside folks in this work for a while, What's your advice for congregations that are we notice that we don't look like our neighbors. We notice that our neighborhood demographics are changing. We want to connect. We want to know that, we're not going to step on anybody's toes or, make a mess of it. What's your advice for a congregation in that place?
Don't expect them to come to you.
Mm.
Go where they are. Don't everybody in the congregation go on the same day. I mean, if you want to feel safe, bring one or two others with you.
Yeah.
But don't overwhelm the space. So all of a sudden it
we call that an mindful. Act of aggression.
Yes. Be mindful.
Yeah.
And walk in humility.
Mm-hmm.
Find the friendly face.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, and don't make it a one-time thing. So don't bring the whole congregation. Well, then you bring those two other people. Well, then you and those two are the ones that are going to continue to come to the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because relationships don't happen overnight.
No.
Just because you showed up once, I don't know you.
Right. Yep.
You showed up once.
Yep.
And now you think I owe you my life story. No.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot say enough, though. Do not expect that people are just going to open up to you because you showed up.
Yeah.
One time.
Yeah.
you don't know what someone has gone through in their day.
Yeah.
Their week. You may be the straw.
Yeah.
And they may unleash on you. And often that is not a personal thing, but they've hit their limit with majority culture invading their life and expecting something back. And so be patient. Don't take it personal. Because that's the other thing. So for as much as majority culture can be cerebral, the minute anybody pushes back, because there's an expectation of you owe me this.
Yeah, exactly.
Unconsciously, often. Yep. Yep. But you owe me this. And then when I say, I'm not doing that, then all of a sudden there's all this offense.
Yeah.
White women's tears. There's a whole bunch of articles out there. Google it. And how they are used to weaponize.
Yeah.
White tears are weaponized against black and brown bodies. So
yeah.
Figure out where you are, too.
Exactly.
Before you engage in that, so that you don't get your feelings hurt. And if you do get your feelings hurt, please don't show it. You take that to someone else.
Yep.
Take that to a white friend.
Yep.
Who can help you process that.
Cry in the car like the rest of us.
Amen. Hallelujah. Or go get in the shower and cry so it doesn't seem like you're crying because it's wet. It's just wet.
That's right.
But don't place, expect someone to help you process that.
Yes.
So really, do your work.
Yeah.
Don't expect people of color to take on your work.
Yeah.
And everybody has work to do.
Yep.
The work is different.
Yes. I appreciate you saying that. I do think that is one of the things, even when we step out into the neighborhood, regardless of who we're trying to engage, there's sometimes this idea that like people are just kind of patiently waiting for us to come out and like be friends with them. Mm-hmm. And they're not.
Mm-mm.
Like our neighbors have plenty to do. They've plenty got friends, they've got family, they've got folks, you know, like you are not the gift you think you are always.
Exactly.
Right?
And they may have a faith community. Don't assume that people are unchurched because they're not going to your church.
To your church. For real.
Because that's what you talked. Mm-hmm. Churches were placed for reasons.
Yes.
And let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
10 o'clock Sunday morning, most segregated hour in America. Let's be real about that.
Yep. Yep.
And there's reasons for that.
Absolutely.
And until folks want to change that, we're not going to get too far in this conversation.
Mm-mm. Felicia, thanks for being here.
Thank you. This is so much fun.
Yeah. We should do this again.
I think so.
Yeah.
I want to be a guest more than Eric.
That's the plan.
Maybe we can have a running thing.
I think that's good. We'll do like a tally and see who wins.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
How about for you? How are you and your congregation paying attention to the way race, culture, and class are impacting the way you think about, talk about, and approach your neighbors? What are the relationships and resources that have been most meaningful and most helpful for you? What are the gifts and strengths you can bring to this important work? And where are there still opportunities to grow and develop? I'm grateful for my guest Felicia Boone, for her voice, her presence, and her leadership in the church, and for the wisdom and compassion she brings to the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I hope this conversation was helpful, and I'm grateful that you tuned in. Blessings on your work building Christian community for the common good, and peace be with you.
Thanks for listening to At the Table, Christian Community for the Common Good. If you've appreciated this conversation, be sure to subscribe to receive updates on new episodes and share this podcast with friends and colleagues. You can also keep up to date by visiting my website, nicholastangen.com. Thanks for listening, and peace be with you.